As Western civilization goes through its paradigm shift, that's a challenge for Christianity. It's something to be run towards and taken on rather than run from. I'm John Loeffler. The program is Steel on Steel.
Steel on Steel. News, commentary, interview, and debate. An alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Now, here's the host of Steel on Steel, John Loeffler.
Times of difficulty and trial tend to test people's faiths. It brings out the true Christianity, and the ones who were pretend Christians, well, they tend to fade away. They have no staying power. But it's also a time of challenge when little people wind up doing great things. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Steel on Steel. John Loeffler here, weekly program dedicated to the sharpening of ideas, news commentary, interview, information, debate. Not as many debates lately as we used to do. But anyway, much of which you will not hear elsewhere. Our goal and pledge for the last 30-plus years that we've been on the air has been to be an early warning service to connect what to many people are seemingly unrelated dots in the area of economics, politics, and religion, project those seemingly unrelated dots into trends, and show you where they're coming together just over the horizon where normally the herd does not see it. Herd will always be running in the wrong direction. That's because they're listening to the wrong information sources, notably the establishment media, who are looking in the rearview mirror to tell us where we're going, or nowadays acting as journalists, activists, purveying narratives, not news. And since all of that is true, and 30-plus years ago, before anybody talked about fake news, we went on the air to be an antidote to that. Please do remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko. If you notice lately here on the program, we've been doing a lot of zooming back. The news is really covering very, very little, and anything that's worth covering, the media, especially the talk channels, are simply not covering it, at least not in the depth that it needs to happen. There are major geopolitical changes occurring. I think it was Melanie Phillips or Carolyn Glick said, we're watching a geopolitical train wreck evolve as the new administration tries to change everything that the Trump administration did. But I want to look at the religious side of the issues. Jeff Kinley has served more than two decades as student pastor and senior pastor at churches, and he heads up Main Thing Ministries, author of 30-plus books. His latest is Aftershocks, Christians Entering a New Era of Global Crisis. And Jeff, you know what's interesting is you have perceived correctly that we are going through a paradigm shift here in the West. It's not just simply a glitch. You know, we're not going back to the old normal, that all sorts of new rules are emerging. And I have been telling friends, if this is not the end times, it is a great dress rehearsal, because you notice that the prophecy that the gospel would be preached to the entire world is actually being fulfilled in our day as the Bible is translated even into the smallest tribes in the remotest parts of the world. Increase for hatred for Christians is occurring worldwide for different reasons, but it's ultimately all on account of Christ. That's the persecution. We're actually seeing now with the evolution of the Great Reset or the Global Reset, which is just another change in terminology from global governance. And prior to that, it was called the New World Order. The name keeps getting changed, but it's just a progression along the same timeline. That's occurring into a globalist aspect. Artificial intelligence is making many of the predictions we've seen in the scriptures come true. How well do you think the church is grappling with this, Jeff, in the midst of all of this, both theologically and then from a how do we live perspective?
Well, I think one thing we can say for sure is that people in the church are being affected much, if not more, than just the general populace. I mean, of course, on the heels of COVID and us going through this galactic seismic shift, as it were, churches began to shut down. I think that initially people thought, well, we'll play along. We'll be good kids on the playground and play along with this thing. But after it became pretty obvious that this thing wasn't going away, I think pastors and congregations started scratching their heads going, wait a minute, is something going on here that we don't know about? So people have been affected. In fact, Barna posted not long ago that 14% of Christians read their Bibles every day, which is dismal, but during COVID, it's dropped to 9%. So with people not going to church, even those who initially started online watching, those have dropped off as well. So we're seeing a real impact on the body of Christ during this whole crisis.
Some of it negative or positive? I think churches that have said, well, we're going to plow ahead regardless, that's a positive. Any other positives or negatives you see in that?
No, I think there are a lot of positives. In fact, I've seen a lot of believers, a lot of churches have just said, you know, this is a great opportunity for us. It's almost like while the world's focused on something else, let's go ahead and focus in on what God wants us to know. So a lot of churches have continued to meet. There are remnants of believers, true believers who desire fellowship, who desire teaching, to say, where can I go to get solid teaching nowadays? I don't know where to go. So during this hiatus that we've been experiencing, a lot of Christians have been reaching out and have experienced a lot of growth.
I can see that. We still have in this country, unlike many other countries, where people just sort of march along with whatever's going on. If they suspect that something isn't right, they eventually let you know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about this. Our whole country was founded on the fact that we're not just going to allow the government to take over our lives, to dictate our lives. And so a lot of Americans are waking up. A lot of Christians are waking up saying, wait a minute, something smells fishy here. What's up with these vaccines? You're not telling us the truth. The stats on COVID and deaths aren't matching up with what we know to be true. So people are beginning to be wise. However, there's a large portion, John, that are still not catching on, that are still just getting in the lazy river and just letting it take them wherever they want to go.
Well, speaking of wherever they want to go, where is we going? How is that? Because we know what this global reset is all about. We're watching an ever-increasing surveillance state form around us. We have flippages, is the best way I can put it, of what is right and what is wrong being foisted down our throats, whether we want it or not. Where do you see us emerging out of this?
Well, the Bible predicts that in the very end of time, there's going to be a one-world government. There's going to be a great cataclysmic change upon the planet. There's going to be a global crisis that's going to enact a man rising to the pinnacle of the political realm. The Bible calls him the Antichrist. And there's going to be a severe governmental control during that time, as well as God's judgment being unleashed on planet Earth. I think what we're seeing is sort of a preview or a sneak preview, or as you said, a dress rehearsal to that time. You see the parallels between having a crisis and going into chaos, having a sense of calm and compliance by the populace, and then government just coming in and saying, nah, I think we'll just keep this thing going forever and we'll just keep controlling you. That's exactly what we see happening in the end times. And so Christians have to wake up. They have to recognize what's happening in their world. And they have to decide, is my government going to cross the line with me? Is it going to get to the point where it's infringing upon not only my liberties as a citizen, but also my faith and my belief system as well? And so I think a time of testing is down the road.
That always concerns me, because whereas Christians in other parts of the world are already in testings, what will the church need in terms of spiritual skill to deal with it? I frankly don't think Americans and Canadians are ready for that.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. In fact, we were talking earlier about some other countries, and Christians are persecuted in some other countries. I've taught and discipled people in those same countries. They're experiencing everything from beheadings to false imprisonment to being burned alive, being raped, dismembered. So we certainly have gotten a pass as far as the persecution realm has gone. But, you know, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, he who builds his house upon my words, upon the word of God, will have a solid house like it's built on a rock. And if you don't, you're built on the sand. And then when this persecution, the rains, the winds blow against your house and they descend against it, then your house will fall. What we have to develop in the church, number one, is a firm faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. And that can only come through the word of God. With the numbers that we're seeing, the declining numbers of not only church attendance, but also reading and studying the Bible going down, I think that tells us that our infrastructure is very weak. The other thing the Bible tells us to do in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, it says, number one, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. In other words, keep coming together each week. You know, God being such a genius, he knows exactly why we need this, is because we're weak people. We need the strength that comes from being together as the body of Christ. And that verse goes on to say, and encourage one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. Well, that day is the day of Christ's return. And as we see ourselves rapidly spiraling toward the end times, we need to be together more. We need to encourage one another more and be strengthened more. And based upon that, then we can be salt and light and a light of hope and help to a world that so desperately needs the gospel.
It's really a very, very important point, because at times you can feel very lonely in what you're doing. I've had pastors tell me that listen to the program in various locations. They say, I'm alone. And I would say, Pastor, you're not alone. You're just separated from other like-minded pastors. That's critical, because you do start to feel like you're alone, and you're not. And you need to be encouraged that you are on the right path, standing on rock. You're not standing on squishy sand like today's constantly changing values.
That's so true. I mean, I think we're at a point where we're really pivoting right now as a culture. I think we've been going down a downward slope in a post-Christian world, but I think recent changes in our government, administration, policies, they're really pivoting on some key values there. At the same time, while there's fear, confusion, people are being misled, there's a lot of white noise out there, I do believe that this is the most exciting time in human history to be alive as a Christian, as a believer. Even though things may get tough for us, they may get difficult for us in the days ahead, this is an irrecoverable moment, really our finest hour, if you will. And so I talk about in the book, how can we come together to strengthen ourselves to be able to face the tough times ahead in a way that gives us confidence, boldness, and most of all, hope.
How do you deal with the question, because you mentioned it in your book, had this conversation, it was almost ongoing with a Lutheran pastor, and I would say, you know, it looks pretty much like these are really getting into end times here. And he'd say, well, they've always thought that way. And he would just try to dismiss the whole thing with that wave of the hand. How do you deal with that?
I would say, number one, we haven't always thought this way. There have been different little points in time where there's been like an oppressive pope or something in the past, and people thought, well, he's the Antichrist. There's been a world war. We thought, well, this is the end of time or whatever. The thing that makes it very different right now is due to the rebirth of Israel on May 14th, 1948. Virtually all the prophecies that we see taking place in the tribulation, especially the ones that deal with the Jewish people, they cannot happen unless the Jewish people are a nation again. And of course, Israel, having been dispersed for over 20 centuries to hundreds of countries across the planet, have finally come back together again. And today there are more Jews living in the land. Up to half of the Jews are living in the land now that are scattered across the world. So that tells us that is really the super sign of the end times for Israel to become a nation. So I would say that's what makes it different. The other thing is that we're actually seeing the convergence of many prophetic streams coming together right now, some in their developmental form, some in their embryonic form, some almost ready to be fulfilled. And I outline each of those in the book there on what prophecies are in the process of being fulfilled. I think all those things combined, John, tell us that this is not just the boy who cried wolf or Chicken Little saying the sky is going to fall, but this is really pointing out what God says in his word. And as I often say, if God fulfilled all of the previous prophecies exactly and literally as he did, then that certainly tells us he'll do the same for the future prophecies as well.
Indeed. And I like to pardon Daniel where toward the end, he finally goes, hey, Gabe, what's this all about anyway? And he's told, never you mind, because these are for days, many days in the future. Yeah. You don't have a need to know about it, Daniel. But the people living in those times would need that information.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because we're not given all the details about some of the things that are even prophesied in the future that even that generation or that people group will understand. But I think it's like this. It's kind of like when you're driving in your car and that dashboard light comes on saying check engine. You can only ignore that for so long before the car just shuts down. And I think what God is doing right now is he's just flashing neon signs across the sky with this global pandemic and everything that's happened to us since then. He's trying to get our attention. Wake up, look and see what's happening around you. The things I told you were going to happen in the future are beginning to take place right now. So we, of all people, need to prepare ourselves for the return of Jesus Christ.
And the role of fear in the midst of all of this.
Fear is the master manipulator. Everything from fear of contracting the virus, the fear of being isolated, fear of your job, fear of the unknown, fear of a future pandemic, all those things I addressed in the book. And fear is a paralyzer, John. It prevents us from doing anything. But God says, he has not given us a spirit of fear. One of the most often repeated commands in the Bible is do not fear. And God is with us. Jesus says, I'm with you in Matthew 28 to the end of the age. So his presence is there to comfort, provide the peace and the hope that we need. There's not one reason why a believer in Jesus should fear during these times.
Any thoughts that we haven't clammed onto here, so to speak, that are really, really important, or if you have blogs or things you'd like people to follow?
Yeah, my Vintage Truth podcast, heard every Monday and Friday. I'm in 85 countries. I've got about 325 episodes up right now covering a variety of biblical, theological, and prophetic topics. So that's really been a great outreach. I also co-host another podcast called the Prophecy Pros podcast once a week with Todd Hampson, and we bring in a lot of things about prophecy to help give people hope. But I would just say that the greatest thing that we need right now in the church and among Christians, John, is discernment and to be able to really see in the dark, seeing our culture, seeing our world, we can know what's going on so that we can accurately not only not be afraid, but to respond to those things and to move forward with a sense of confidence.
I might add to that, stop knee-jerking. This is something that's really concerning me, is that people are flipping and flopping and they're grabbing onto the latest rumors of this and that. You have to have a steadier keel than that.
No, I agree. And I think that's exactly what the Bible does for us. When people come in with all these new theories, new ideas, new mandates, that type of thing, we need to remain calm in this thing because we're sort of in the eye of the hurricane as believers, because Christ has promised us, he said, in the world, you're going to have tribulation, but take courage, I've overcome the world. So our ship can still be steadied in the rough seas that we're all in right now.
Pastor Jeff Kinley, a timely book for, well, maybe the end times coming to a church near you. How's that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, once again, Jeff Kinley, KINLEY.com. Really appreciate it, Jeff.
Thank you, John.
I think the takeaways from this interview are the recognition here that we are in a great paradigm shift. Number two, don't knee-jerk to everything that's going on out there. I see people doing a lot of that, going after sidebar or corollary issues as if they were the main event. That's what's troubling me more than anything else right now, without having the overview. Now, you come to the point of saying, are we or are we not in the end times? And some people have glibly always blown that off by saying, oh, yes, well, people have thought that during the history of the church and blah, blah, blah. So we can't do that. We should just always be ready, whatever that means. It is such a trite statement. It's almost disgusting. The response is, well, then means Jesus is never coming, right? We're accountable for two things. Number one, no one knows the day or the hour. It comes like a thief in the night. But we are held accountable for the times and the seasons, and the scriptures, the prophecies of the end times were written for people who would live in those end times, because we are told in the scriptures that this will be, the worst time that has ever come upon the face of the earth ultimately. And number two, that we should know how to not be surprised by it, not be afraid by it, to lift up your head as you see the day draws near, to maintain your faith, to run the race as if to win, and the mandate is still the same. Go around, the harvest is ripe, go around and begin collecting what other people have sown in times of helping people to understand what's happening, that God understood this, and that there's a purpose for their lives. That's the most important part. I think realizing that keeps you from being too drawn in by anything. Now, let me point out something that's really important here. People will say, well, if they're not at the end time, they get in this dilemma of, do I protest against things that are wrong, or do I say, I hit this a lot in the 90s when I was trying to alert people early on what was coming to the west of the country. And they would say, well, we don't have to worry about that because Jesus is coming. You know, you wanted to slap them in holy charity, right? You stupid idiot. Love you, brother. because they were just being so trite about onrushing changes and challenges that would be facing the church. It used to really grieve me. But it doesn't make any difference whether these are actually the end times or not. The mandate, the primary mandate, make disciples, is always there. Two, the mandate of bearing witness to truth is there. Three, the mandate to build your house upon rock, meaning God's word and Christ in particular, and that will help you get through the storms that are coming, because the storms will be all sorts of people coming along, and we're seeing that today in the West, saying this is right, that's wrong, this is wrong. They're making it up as they go along and expect everybody else to step in Zeke Heil march step with what they're doing, telling us it's for the great and the good, and they're going to get rid of everything that's wrong in civilization, even as they themselves don't seem to be able to achieve it. That's why we have rock to stand on. But there may be some challenges, too, because people who oppose these things are losing their jobs, and there are other costs to be paid, shaming, getting thrown out of colleges. It depends. That's how abusive the whole thing has gotten. Resembles the days of the Spanish Inquisition or any other time when a theocracy took charge and began ramrodding its beliefs down on everybody else and then closed off freedom of belief and speech. Nevertheless, you have the truth. Your job and assignment is still the same. And above all, do not fear those who can destroy the body and after that have nothing that they can possibly do, but fear him who can destroy the body and cast the soul into hell. That's the one that we should be afraid of. On behalf of Steve Schiller, producer, we're at steelonsteel.com. I'm John Leffler. The program is Steel on Steel. You know, quite frequently we've been talking about the rising anti-Semitism in Europe, notably in Great Britain, as a matter of fact. There are three sources of it coming against Jews in Europe. Number one is the old anti-Semitism, which has always been there. It's been latently there. It went underground after World War II because of the Holocaust. The second source, of course, is the large number of Muslim immigrants into Europe. And the third source is what I call the nouveau anti-Semitism, which is coming from the left, which is the one that's really a head scratcher. It's appearing here now in this country. It is becoming not a safe place for certain Jews on college campuses, especially where there are BDS movements. But given the fact that critical race theory is in vogue going on college campuses, and considering that we could say that Jews have been a very oppressed group, and critical race theory divides groups into oppressor groups and oppressed groups, one would have to scratch one's head as to exactly why it is the Jews seem to be on the wrong side of this whole thing. Steve Stotsky is joining me, senior research analyst at CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. Let's look at critical race theory. You know, they divide everything into oppressors and oppressed. The oppressors cannot help but be oppressors. They tie it to race and class most of the time, of which you are hopeless. And the oppressed people will always be oppressed and victims no matter what opportunities they've passed up in their lives. How then does this apply to anti-Semitism today?
There's a couple of different strands that naturally lead proponents of critical race theory and more broadly the social justice movement into hostile stance towards Jews and especially towards Israel. First of all, looking just at what a traditional American education did versus what the changes are afoot with the critical race theory and social justice movement. The traditional education grounded Americans from all sorts of backgrounds in the founding principles of the Declaration of Independence and Constitution, liberty and equality. And it also, traditional American education, reinforced our adherence to a moral society based on the Judeo-Christian tradition. Now, other societies like Israel share these values and are seen as natural allies. This has also allowed American Jews to be both loyal Americans and defenders of Israel and see no conflict between these sentiments. Now, the proponents of critical race theory, they're really the most visible element of this political movement that doesn't share these positive affirmations of the United States and its allies like Israel. So, you know, we see this in the academic environment, particularly where the social justice movement is deeply entrenched and where social justice and critical race theory adherents prevail. They've shown themselves to be totally intolerant to opposing opinions. And this we know as the cancel culture, which we see on the campus and in the media. They focus a lot on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because they connect that with other struggles that they champion. So first you have to look at the parallels they see between America and Israel. They draw parallels. Now, in America, it's built upon this unique idea that not tribal loyalties, not bloodlines or any specific religious conviction, but it's instead upon the principles of the Declaration of Independence, freedom and equality. As you said, the advocates of critical race theory and racial identity movement, which are really two parts of this thing, they have a different formulation for American society, and they perceive America through the prism of white supremacy, colonialism, and the sin of slavery. And so why are they antagonistic toward American Jews? Well, the social justice critical race theorists, activists, they threaten these hard-fought gains that Jews have of social acceptance and economic prosperity, and they resent it. These advocates of social justice and critical race theory don't acknowledge that in our free system, individual initiative is the main source of prosperity, and they don't accept that individuals should have a right to keep their gains. Instead, they see societal wealth imbalances as evidence of systemic racism, white privilege, and Jews who have prospered in America are seen as beneficiaries of this white privilege. And this was a big part of the controversy in the recent ethnic studies curriculum in California, in which the treatment of Israel and the inclusion of anti-Semitic tropes was a major source of controversy. And of the 90,000 letters sent to the California Department of Education, nearly half related to their treatment of the Jews and of Israel.
I think we could also see when we come to Israel, remember that Israel started out as an underdog fighting back against five Arab armies that were trying to eradicate it back in 1948. But nowadays, you have rockets pouring into Israel from Gaza. The media say virtually nothing. I mean, this can happen on an ongoing basis. But the moment Israel tries to defend itself and do surgical strikes into Gaza, that's horrible. There's world outcry. And it's that whole narrative of oppressors and oppressed again.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get into, actually, was how these advocates of critical race theory and social justice, how they cast Israel in Zionism, which is what you're really getting at here. They consider Israel guilty of many of the same sins as the United States. They have no empathy for the Jews' 2,000-year-old dream of returning from bitter exile to their homeland. Instead, they see Israel as a colonial settler state. They claim that it has stolen the land from the people they consider to be its indigenous inhabitants, the Palestinian Arabs. And they claim that Israel engages in systemic racism towards its Arab minority within Israel and toward the Palestinians in the territory. So there are a lot of parallels to how they view Israel in its relations with the Palestinian Arabs and how they view America and its relations toward its minority populations, its black, as well as the indigenous Native Americans, the Indians. And so anyways, the account they offer is a contrived account, and it ignores and it conceals much. But it does support their beliefs and their political goals, so they don't care. What they do when they bring this into the classroom is they exclude from their classrooms the crucial elements in the history of Israel establishment that really repudiate their version of events. So these are a few things that I encounter, that the distortions that I encounter in how they present the Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. First of all, when they present this, they deny the extensive evidence of the Jewish presence on the land going back to biblical times. This is long before the Arabs arrived as invaders in the 7th century AD, which is also often not explained. Secondly, they gloss over the centuries of history of repeated Jewish nationhood on the land, the only people actually who have established a nation on the land. They gloss over or don't even cover the expulsions, the persecutions, and then the centuries of neglectful Ottoman Turkish rule that resulted in a depopulated land. And then they choose as their starting point, this is very important to their whole narrative, they choose as their starting point the late 19th century when the Jewish population was just a remnant at its lowest ebb, and the Arabs who lived in that region, in that area, outnumbered the Jews. So they use this as a starting point, and then they insist that the Arabs are the land's indigenous inhabitants, and the Jews who came along are foreign usurpers, and they justify Arab refusal to live in peace with Israel because of that. Another thing was that, and this relates to some of what's going on even today, is that how they misrepresent Israeli societies that currently exist. They conceal the fact that the Arab minority has full legal rights, including the right to vote, and they do vote for their own representatives. Their distortions of Israeli society are actually quite similar to the distortions of American society. They also call uneven outcomes in school achievement and prosperity as evidence of systemic racism, something that in common to both America and to Israel is how they present this. Now, like America, Israel is a vibrant society whose citizens from all backgrounds participate in the democracy, but the critical race theorists really deny this. They don't consider this. Instead, like in America, they exaggerate the flaws that exist and they amplify incidents that occur, and then they propagate this libelous account and block attempts to provide accurate information, to provide the context and provide more information on what's going on. And now, a commonly encountered example I'll give you, I see this virtually all the curricula that I've seen in schools, is that they blame Israeli intransigence, the Israeli leader, particularly Netanyahu, the lack of a peace agreement. But they conceal that it's the Palestinians, their leadership, who are actually the ones who refuse to negotiate and refuse to compromise on any of their demands. And they don't tell the students that the Palestinians to this very day refuse to acknowledge Israel's right to exist. And I'm not talking about Hamas, though, man. I'm talking about the Palestinian Authority, who is often presented as the moderate peace-seeking group. They still refuse to acknowledge Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Another example, which I commonly come across, is that they conceal the long trail of Palestinian Arab terrorism so that students don't really understand what compelled Israel to build its security barrier and impose security measures like checkpoints. And this goes right to your point about how they present the news today. They present it as an Israeli aggression, but they always reverse cause and effect. And the same with how they present the security barrier and the checkpoints. They like to present this as some sort of imposition. They call it Israeli apartheid. But actually, what brought this about, of course, was the campaign of terror, the suicide bombers, during 2000-2005.
So what is the antidote to this now? Because ultimately, cancel culture is nothing but the execution of critical race theory. But cancel culture in its very nature, if you notice, it is full of contradiction, and it ultimately will wind up canceling itself as well as everybody else. Anybody who walks off the reservation, so to speak, is viciously attacked, or who deviates from it's almost a religious orthodoxy. So what's the antidote to it then?
Yeah, first let me just address your question, but I'll go further with what you're saying. I consider myself a student of history. I love history. And one of the real basic roots of this philosophy or this belief system is, of course, Marxism. When you see how, like in the history of the Soviet Union, how when Stalin took power, for example, he went after the old Bolsheviks. So there was always, like you say here, what that goes on here, it feeds on itself. It always needs to find new enemies and new victims. And that, I think, is what we're seeing here as well in America with the critical race theory, when they start attacking anybody who dares to challenge, even from their own side, who dares to challenge any aspect of it. Now, as far as what needs to be done, the most important things, first of all, people have to realize that there has been a takeover of American education and many parts of American education by these adherents to this far-left Marxist and racial identity belief system. It's been underway for many years, probably 50 or 60 years, really. But really just only recently has it gained the kind of public exposure that people are looking at and are outraged by it. And so, first of all, parents have to do some really basic things. They have to pay attention to what their children are being taught. They have to look at the materials that their children bring home, the assignments, and they have to ask questions about what the teachers are teaching them. And they have to realize you can't simply rely on the schools to properly educate your children. We wish we could, but you can't. Parents should review homework assignments, the reading material, and they should also, here's a key one, is pay attention to the questions on classroom tests that are given to children. This is a real indicator of what they're being taught. And then parents have to be willing to speak up when they encounter teaching that goes against their beliefs or simply not providing their children with appropriate lessons for them to learn. And what we're seeing actually around the country these days is really very encouraging, actually, is that parents are organizing. You know, it's very important to attend school board meetings, voice your concerns. And the most important thing, and we're really starting to see this all around the country, in Texas, I know, this happened. In Virginia, this is happening, where you have to put up candidates for school boards. People have to be willing to run for school boards and take back these school boards. School boards have been taken over by union-supported candidates and far-left ideologues, and they have to be taken back. And the other thing is also contact your political representatives. Let them know that the situation in schools bother you, because the politicians do have a lot of influence over the education bureaucracy, because they're the ones who approve the budgets. And finally, if all else fails, look to homeschooling or charter schools. Find alternative to the public schools if it's just there's nothing else you can do.
Okay. Gee, you just said what I was going to say.
Okay.
Is that, you know, it's been interesting because we're running parallels on the Christian side of the slate in that when you look at it, critical race theory, it's a Marxist system. You and I know it's just a rehash of class theory that existed 50 years ago. Frankfurt School, Leipzig School, you can talk about these things. But it's fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. And yet we see the people trying to bring these two things together. They talk about the social gospel or social justice is really what Jesus was all about, yada, 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 yada. And it's just simply not
right.
True. It's just simply not
right.
True.
It strikes me, I'm certainly not an expert on the religious element of this, but it strikes me as an attempt to replace Christianity, or as I indicated earlier in my comment, as replacing the American creed of individual freedom. So I think this is part of it. It's an alternative belief system.
It most definitely is. It has all the hallmarks of a theology. And it's also got an inquisition. That's what cancel culture is all about. Everybody
right.
must adhere to
right.
it.
And people should realize that when talking about it as a belief system, it's not an educational program in the normal sense. There are no studies, no rigorous studies anyways, that validate it, that show that students have better academic outcomes or do better in life economically by being given these kind of curricula that includes this kind of material.
It's very true. At the very same time, we tend to be falling in terms of being able to do math, reading, writing, you know, all the basic skills are destroyed. But that, again, was a change in education that kicked in the 1980s, was the shift in emphasis.
Right. Parents should insist on, that's one of the best ways actually to oppose all this, is not necessarily even to get into an ideological battle, but simply to say, we need to spend more time, the children need to spend more time and be educated better in learning how to do math and reading, learning how to write, and learning basic American history. They need to spend more time on that. If nothing else, this kind of injections into the curricula of these critical race theory and racial identity ideas takes away time from other things that are much more needed.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Steve Stotsky, Senior Research Analyst at CAMRA, and they're at camra.org. Any closing thoughts?
I do have just one closing thought, but thank you, by the way, for this discussion. I really appreciate it. The one closing thought I would still recommend, the most straightforward thing parents can do to counter this is to get books for your children to read. You choose the books. Don't just rely on the schools to provide the reading. They don't provide much good reading anymore. Go to the libraries or online and find good books, the kind of books you want your children to read, and encourage them to read. That's the most important thing for developing a child's mind.
All right, Steve, I do appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was talking by Skype with Dr. Kamil Majdali, who is currently in the UK. He lives in Australia, but he's been stuck in the UK during a lot of the lockdown. We were talking about the whole issue that, well, what do you do? What do you tell people about this time when we don't know what's happening? Well, it is uncharted territory. Absolutely. And this unchartedness covers those three segments: politics, economics, and religion. That's okay, because God doesn't change. And God knows that we were born into this time, and God knew what was going to happen in this time, and God is our guide through this. And so technically, I should be freaking out. I'm not, because, well, here we go. What are we going to do today? Show me what's important today, Lord, and what you want me to do with X, whatever it is you need help with, and he'll show you that. Okay, that's the important part. So sometimes we've been billed as the best bad news in town. Okay, I got that. But remember, everything you see here on this planet someday is going to burn. It's going to go. That's it. We come, we go. Governments come, they go. But God's kingdom is eternal, and that's the important one. We're just passing through and carrying out our responsibilities while we do so. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller, I'm John Loeffler. We are at steelonsteel.com. The program, it is a program, right? We're still a program? Good. Okay, the program is Steel on Steel. Maybe it's time to review the rules of what happens when words become weaponized. I used to say there were three stages, and now, to my great shame, or actually innovation, there are actually four stages. Now, the first stage is where a word such as racism, white supremacist, you know the shtick, they have fairly concise meanings, fairly concise definitions. Unfortunately, once they're weaponized, that's not convenient to contain those definitions, so it goes to stage two. That's when the definitions become broadened out to cover anything that needs to be covered within the definition. So you hear people running around saying, well, he's a Nazi, when he has nothing to do with Nazism. He doesn't look like a Nazi or talk like one. They broaden it out. The third stage is where the word becomes meaningless, because it's used so often to cover so much stuff, everybody shrugs their shoulders and go, yeah, well, whatever. Say whatever you want. And the fourth stage is the bizarre one. That's where flippage occurs, and the word comes to mean the opposite of what is being meant originally from the word. There was a story, I don't know if you're following the issues of the numbers of pastors that have been arrested in the province of Alberta, Canada. This is a parallel story, but the mayor of Calgary, which I call the Denver of Canada, Calgary Mayor Naheed Nenshi has claimed that anti-mask and anti-lockdown protests in Canada during the pandemic are, quote, thinly veiled white nationalist supremacist activities, and condemned the demonstrators. We saw the same thing here with the Tea Party movement. And the Tea Party movement, when it came about in 2008, said, we want less government. We want accountable government. You're in far overreach. It needs to be scaled back. We want lower taxes. And we want a lot of our rights to be restored, especially constitutional rights. Immediately, the opposition began screaming, racist! Well, where did that come from? When was it that being a patriot of your country suddenly became a bad thing? And that's what I want to talk about, is this type of flippage. Robert Curry is joining me right now. He's a member of the board of directors of the Claremont Institute, author of Common Sense Nation, Unlocking the Forgotten Power of the American Idea, and Reclaiming Common Sense, Finding Truth in a Post-Truth World. But you know, Robert, one of the things that happened, as you've pointed out in a number of articles, I remember an age when modern Democrat schemes would be laughed out of the room. I always point out, I really haven't moved that much. And so what in the 60s, we called their ideas extremely radical. Today, we're being called the radicals or the extremists. And in reality, they just went so far in their direction that those of us who didn't move looked to them as being extreme. But we've had the same thing happen in terms of what we're doing to the Constitution. There's this constant effort to overthrow all of this and thinking that the whole republic will remain the way it is as soon as they've done that. That's the bizarre contradiction. So I don't know where you want to fly with that, but it revolves around these articles you've been writing on that.
Well, thank you, John. Well, I think many of us are aware that something's gone wrong with the federal government. The founders' idea was that the federal government would be limited in its powers. But the federal government we have today is an unlimited government, evidently. Every time the Democrats get control, they expand government dramatically. And too often when the Republicans are in control, government expands too. So the original idea was limited government, but what we have is rapidly growing government with no evident limitation. So what happened? Well, what happened is, and everybody recognizes that, all our people recognize that, and even the left knows that they're doing that, But, you know, not one person in 100 or maybe one person in 1,000 knows how it was done. And how it was done was that the progressives very cleverly overthrew and abolished the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment, what it basically said was, all of the powers that weren't delegated to the federal government were retained by the states. And the powers delegated to the federal government were very few. It was a very limited list. Here's what Madison said in The Federalist. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Well, that's not what we have today. The federal government is interfering in our lives in every way. So here's what happened. The 10th Amendment was kept in place by the fact that until the 17th Amendment, the state legislatures chose the senators. So what happened? The Senate was able to defend the states collectively from the federal government. So now, without having the state legislatures choose the senators, what's happened is that the federal government has grown and grown and grown, and more the state governments have been suppressed, and even worse, they now reflect the overweening reach of the federal government. So basically, the American people were tricked into abolishing the most important of the Bill of Rights, because the strength of the 10th Amendment was rooted in the political power of the Senate.
Yeah, because the idea was, remember, the whole principle of our government was lots of checks and balances of different groups counterbalancing other groups.
Yes.
The effort now is to now begin to merge that all into a single party system and abolish a lot of the rights. That's what I meant when I said in the beginning, they're working very hard at dismantling this, thinking that we will look like we do now or then after they've taken all the foundation apart. That's not going to happen. Originally, the people would elect the representatives. The House of Representatives was based on population. The Senate gave each state 2 votes. The other issue was the states elected the senator, not the people of the states, but the legislatures. And of course, in the event of a death of a senator, the governor could appoint a replacement so that the states would have a say in what was going on versus the mob, so to speak. It was a brilliant system, to be honest with you.
Right. And the progressives were brilliant to strike. Really, the progressive states of America began with the 17th Amendment, and they were brilliant in what they chose. They posed it as a reform, but what they struck down was the key protection in the Constitution for your and my individual rights. The fact that they were able to get away with it was only because American people would have rejected it if they had remembered the idea. The founders would certainly have rejected the 17th Amendment because it overthrew the most important amendment in the Bill of Rights. The original design of the Constitution reflected the bargain that was made. Before the Constitution was ratified, each of the states had their own foreign policy. They had their own trade agreements. They were really independent, and America was just a confederation. Founders' idea was, we'll be better able to represent ourselves with foreign powers if we had a central government that would handle those matters. And that was what they were going to handle. The idea of the federal government is it was only going to take over those responsibilities which could be better handled by a central government. Here's Madison again. They were going to handle America's relations with foreign states. In Madison's words, war, peace, negotiations, and foreign commerce. Now, additionally, the federal government was going to make sure that we had free commerce among the states. So it had a role in having the states stop creating tariffs between each other and those things that made America the big economy that it could be. So the federal government was concerned with relations with foreign states and relations among the states in terms of mostly of commerce. That was the original idea. But once the Senate was no longer populated by the state legislatures, the states couldn't protect themselves from the government's overweening reach. And guess what? There went our ability to protect ourselves from the federal government's overreach. So now, you know, I mean, the Obama administration, they virtually took over health care, and if they took over student loans, what does that have to do with war, peace,
I tell you what else,
foreign commerce?
What else changed that, too? And you properly benchmarked 1913 as the suspect date, because that's when we started the income tax.
Yep.
And what the income tax allowed was that revenues would flow from the people around the states directly to the federal government. That empowered it to begin funding itself and not be beholden to the states for their income and revenues. Very same thing the United Nations has been trying to do all along. It's trying to get a global tax going. So why? So that it can become an independent, self-standing government. And then the next thing that happened in 1913, you know what I'm going to say, the Federal Reserve. We created a central bank that's neither federal nor reserve. I would say the other thing that contributed to it, Robert, is what I call smearage. And let me give you an example.
Okay.
The navigable waterways of the United States. In other words, the original Constitution only intended to have federal government involved in things that involve movement between states to regulate commerce, to act like a referee between states.
That's right.
Now, for example, under the Environmental Protection Agency, the definition of the navigable waterways has been extended to any drop of water that might flow into those waterways, including the little creek my kids used to like to tube down in the spring when it was flooding. That's the only time you could navigate down that creek. That is the kind of overreach extension that is absurd. Why is the federal government involved in all of this firearms regulations? What goes on in a state should be of no concern to the federal government. If my wife has a headache and I see her, I have a pain pill the doctor prescribed, why don't you take one? I've committed a felony. I can't transfer the prescription from me to her. It should be none of their business. You see what I'm saying? All of this stuff is none of their business. But in Washington, they think they can't get along without us.
Well, what they're doing, John, is there is no final point except total government. They're going to keep on expanding government until we get total government. And you know the ism word for total government, right?
Yeah, totalitarianism.
I believe that you have that correct.
That's where it goes. Now, some states, to their credit now, the states have awakened to the idea that we need to turn this back. For example, marijuana laws. Just 3 miles from where I am in Washington State, marijuana is legal. In Idaho, it's not legal. That's one of the differences between the two. If firearms are manufactured in the state and they don't cross state lines as far as sale and commerce, should be none of the federal government's business. So there is starting to be pushback, but when you let your rights erode so badly as they have done, it's really hard to regain them. And the flip side on that, of course, was remember that during the time of segregation, states' rights were used as a defense of why the states didn't have to comply with federal laws regarding, you know, freedom for all individuals, regardless of race. The problem with that now, as you well see, there's that smearage again, is that, okay, everybody could finally agree nobody should be discriminated against on the basis of religion or race or creed, etc. But once you let that horse out of the barn, look at all the people that want to ride it now.
Yes, we would be in such good shape if the federal government, you know, the federal government does a lousy job in everything that it does. It's just a fact. They got lots of employees, but most of them are just making trouble. But if the federal government still only had war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce as its responsibility, there's a chance that it could do a lot better job because it's not doing so darn many things. And all these matters of water and firearms and marijuana and stuff, according to the founders, all of that would be left to the individual states. So their idea was, federal government was going to be very limited, and politics was going to be robustly local. And you have a chance, you know, to influence the politics in your town. And if you don't like the politics in your town, Americans had a perfect willingness to get up and move. It's kind of in our veins, isn't it? And so what you would have was people living according to their ideas about how things should be very differently in Idaho and in Washington. And the federal government concerning itself with the important issue of the nation's safety from foreign invasion or somehow being taken advantage of by foreign governments. This was their workable system, which we had at the beginning of the 20th century and which was mostly gone by the end of the 20th century.
I think it's also important to point out that right from the start, you have the early progressives and Woodrow Wilson, you know, President Wilson always pops into mind as one of the leads in there, not to mention John Dewey. They hated the Constitution. They hated the freedoms.
Hated it.
Right. Just hated it. And they set about, and their successors and converts, to destroy this on a step-by-step basis, as it has been said a number of times, like even Richard Gardner back in Council on Foreign Relations in the 1970s, who said, the road to world order is going to be achieved step-by-step, eroding national sovereignty. So they set about actually reducing the sovereignty of the country deliberately.
Well, that's why they hate Trump so much, you know. He got up there and said something that just really, I mean, people just went insane because he said the responsibility of the government is first its own people, not only here in America, but everywhere. The responsibility of a government is to protect their people and to see to the well-being of their people. Well, that went against the globalist enterprise you just explained perfectly, and that's why they hate him so much. That was the reason they hated him, because that's the unsayable thing that he said.
Right. And that's why when they reject what he's saying, they have to cloak it in something else like the overused word racist or
yes.
Nazi. And you'll never see this issue discussed in those terms. And the tragedy is, and this is again to the slippage that occurred, where was education? Originally, education was at the local school board. That's what determined what we were going to do. And then the states were involved. But then the states turned over their responsibility to the federal government by queuing up at the federal money trough. And they only get a small, I think it's like 5% or something of the monies that come into education in the states comes from the federal government, yet they're willing to prostitute themselves, which is always funny because when you talk to educators and public school teachers, you can get them to agree that American education has serious problems. And they'll always add right after that, but it's not in my school. So then the next question is, well, now, wait a minute, do you print your own textbooks or do you use the national that are put out by Houghton Midland and the other groups of people that are out there? Oh, no, we use their textbooks. Well, then it's in your school because your problem is the curriculum. They discuss classroom size, teacher salary, amount of funding, but never, 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 never will the core problem be in that we have changed what we have taught our children about the history of the country and why we are what we are. And that's why we are where we are.
Yeah. The Education Department only was begun in 1979. It was one of Carter's expansions on federal government. And boy, what better proof do we have that the Federal Department of Education is a terrific mistake? Billions of dollars are thrown around, but between 79 and today, education has gone straight down. And I think we can trace a lot of it to the power of the federal government to bribe the states into going along with all kinds of insane ideas. You can't find a crazier group in Washington than the people at the Department of Education. That is a nut house. And the fact that it's a nut house is perfectly reflected in what they've managed to do to education since 1979. Now, I hate to say a word against Ronald Reagan, but boy, he sure as at least should have gotten rid of that darn thing.
Yeah, but look, the Bushes, both of them, were as much in bed with the education establishment in Texas and in the federal government as anybody else.
You betcha.
So the only answers now to all of this are people starting to reassert their rights, reassert education rights, but it's a hard uphill slug now because the whole attitude of the country has been changed over 50 years thanks to what's been taught in education. It was designed right from the start. You can go back and read what the educrats were saying in the 40s to get people away from the idea of patriotism, to get them away from the idea of sovereignty, do away with free markets, and introduce socialism and internationalism. They made it real clear.
That's why I wrote the two books, John. If we could just get enough Americans, I don't know what the number is, but maybe a third of Americans, or maybe as little as a third, really alive to these matters and really understanding how it was done and what they're about, I think we could rapidly change things for the better. The American heart is still the American heart. But what happens is that Americans don't realize that the 17th overthrew the 10th Amendment, that the Education Department is why their school is so bad. But if people could get the idea, we could get rid of the Department of Education and we could begin to downsize the federal government, we could return to the founders' vision. Hey, we could even fix the Senate. It's possible it could be done, and it could be done in just a few years if the American people would only wake up to what is needed. And instead of wandering around, which is so many people are doing now, very unhappy, but not understanding what's being done to them.
Right. That's why Californians, when they leave California, and they're leaving in droves.
Yes.
They go, but many of them do not understand. They don't like California. They don't like what it's become. California has wrecked its, or is wrecking its economic system. And the only thing that's keeping it afloat is Silicon Valley and the Hollywood types, what I call the rich belt along the coast there from San Jose, or San Francisco, down to San Diego. The inland part of the state is becoming a disaster. They have wrecked their water policy. I can't think of every policy they haven't just wrecked, but they have no comprehension of why it is. So when the Californians go to another state, it's like a disease. They take it with them and begin to spread it where they are.
It's an intellectual plague. It really is.
Yeah.
And that's why the answer is in understanding. That's why what you're doing is so important. That's why I wrote the books. Common Sense Nation is about, here's the founders' understanding of what they were doing in their terms. If you understand this, you know exactly what direction we have to go on any subject under the sun. And, you know, reclaiming common sense is reminding everybody that the founders believed that it was the common sense of the sovereign people be how we'd make decisions. And it's a defense of common sense. Well, of course, you know, right now in Washington, you know the stuff that's coming out of there. I mean, every pronouncement and every executive order is in defiance of common sense. They're doing it on purpose.
Yeah, it's not unknown. And President Obama, remember, there is that point when you begin to listen to the rhetoric of President Obama. He's talking about a total transformation of the society. Okay, well, what are we transforming from and what will it look like when we get to? And of course, the answer is nothing but Marxism, and totalitarian ideas. That's what we're just seeing. You can't ignore this if you just look at where they're going. The only difference is it's cloaked as you go running through the middle stage.
Yeah, they're pretty excited right now. They really see that they are close, that their dream of basically total government is within reach. They think they can get rid of the Electoral College, and when they get there, that it's game over for every. That's the last remnant of the founder's design. And you get rid of the Electoral College and pack the Supreme Court, and that's really game over. In other words, their assessment, and I think they're pretty smart about these things, their assessment is that they are closer to their goal than the country is to the founder's vision. And I think it's pretty obvious that that's true. They've come a long way. And they are excited now and going nuts because they think they can get this thing done and done soon.
Right. And there are a few things in the way, and that's what they tend to. If you watch where the greatest freakout is, then you know the thing that they consider the greatest threat to that goal.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So you always know you're over the target when the flak gets really bad.
Just like World War II.
That's exactly. All right. Robert Curry, member of the board of directors of the Claremont Institute, claremont.org, and his articles appear at American Thinker, and I'm assuming other places, but your books are Reclaiming Common Sense, Finding Truth in a Post-Truth World, and Common Sense Nation, Unlocking the Forgotten Power of the American Idea. If nothing else, at least, we're not going, peaceably into that dark night.
That's right. I think America can still be saved because there's love for America and basically a reverence for the founders is not dead. The progressives hate those people and hate their ideas, but most Americans don't. The trouble is most Americans don't know enough about what the
founders
thought. That's
right. I'm glad that's what you said because that's the part. I see that in members of my own family when they say stuff. You don't understand why it's in there and why it's so important. All right, Bob, we'll have you back again.
John, I just love talking with you. Thanks for having me today.
You know, a lot of times watching the media, if you watch what comes down, you get the impression that large numbers of people are really behind that and that you may be in a minority. I've had pastors call and tell me, I'm alone where I am. And I said, well, you're not alone, you're just separate. Remember the whole bit about how many men have bent the knee to Baal in the Old Testament in the times of Elijah? They were just separated, so it was hard to tell where they were. In reality, a lot of people on both the left and the right are recognizing that something has gone radically amiss, and that's a positive, not a negative. And getting back to foundations is always an important thing to do. Jesus said, build your foundation on what? Rock. Of course, he's talking about himself from a religious standpoint, but it's also true for your worldview. Build your worldviews on rock. Today's worldviews, people are built on squishy sand. And that's a challenge because they will be affected by that as well. It has both temporal effects and eternal effects. So do remember to pray for us, pray for those suffering for their faith around the world, especially in the country of Nigeria, where thousands of people have been killed. Over 20,000 people have been killed in the last 10 years. Attacks of Muslim groups such as Boko Haram or Fulani herdsmen upon Christians there in Nigeria, especially for that country. And pray for our governments at all different levels. This is a challenging time. We should pray for guidance and righteousness and let God lead the rest. Till next week, on behalf of producer Steve Schiller and our special programming producer, Carol Loeffler, I'm John Loeffler. We're at steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel.